Our second case this morning is Anderson against Trotter.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook. May it please the court, I'm Gregory Kathis for appellants Trotter and Hateko. Appellant Noonan is separately represented. This appeal has been narrowed in two significant respects. The first is that our opponents have declined to defend against our appeal on behalf of appellant Trotter, and therefore I won't be addressing that unless the court has questions. The second is that with respect to appellant Hateko, the district court on summary judgment specifically rejected most of the factual theories asserted by the other side as a basis for imposing liability. We take the district court's sufficiency determinations on summary judgment as we find them, both the favorable ones and the unfavorable ones, and we pursue this appeal based on the facts found supported by the district court. As a result of his sufficiency determinations, the case against appellant Hateko rests entirely on the fact that on one theory, and that is that Mr. Hateko, in the course of ordinary business at O'Care, reviewed information about people found smuggling drugs, disseminated the information to subordinate officials in the ordinary course of his supervisory activities, and that is the sole basis on which the district court held this case could go forward. We are talking about a neutral practice.
When you say sole basis, that raises the question what the record shows about what Hateko and Noonan, I'll ask Noonan's lawyer when he comes, knew about the differential success rate in the selections of black women and, say, white men. What does the record show about what Hateko knew about that and when he knew it?
The district court, Judge Easterbrook, specifically rejected that theory as a basis for liability. What the record shows is that there were four categories of statistics proffered by the other side. The differential rate that you are referring to comes from certain negative search reports, and what the district court found and what the record shows is that those reports did not even exist until much later in the litigation when the plaintiffs compiled them for purposes of the litigation. So we don't think there could be any basis for using that information.
I'm not really asking about the legal sufficiency. I'm asking about timing. And I take it your position is on timing that at the relevant periods while searches were being conducted,
right,
Hateko did not have that information.
Correct.
And there was no internal, was there any internal data gathering system at Customs that would generate such information?
The information The information that Hateco had were daily reports of seizure incidents, incidents where agents searched individuals and actually found drugs. The broader statistical information that the district court discusses at length about who is being searched over large periods of time, all of that was compiled much later. There is a GAO report which didn't exist until a few years later. There are the negative search reports which the plaintiffs assembled for purposes of this case. I should say, for the sake of completeness, the plaintiffs also ran a theory that Hateco must have known about the statistics reflected in the Trotter email. The district court held that argument to have been waived, but more, perhaps more significantly, those statistics were not collected until at least mid-1998. They were assembled as a result of a request from a senator made in mid-1998, so they cannot possibly be the basis for imputing liability to Hateco with respect to the searches at issue in this appeal, which arise during a four-month interval in 1997. So none of the arguments about statistics and so on, which the district court resolved in our favor, we think can fairly be invoked here as an alternative ground for affirming his order. The order stands or falls on his theory, the district court's theory, that liability can be based solely on the collection and dissemination of truthful information about many variables of people caught with drugs. This is not a case in which the allegation is that the supervisory official disseminated information only on an occasion where there happened to be a lot of black women caught with drugs. It's not a case in which the allegation is that the supervisory official only tracked race and sex variables.
Well, Judge Hart was relying on the fact that they found drugs on four black women in connection with this time of this delay.
With respect to that one incident, but remember, the district court's chain of inference to suppose that Hateco disseminated information about that incident. There was no testimony about people specifically remembering that incident.
The testimony
was that in general what happened was that customs would collect this information and discuss it in the ordinary course in their weekly meetings, and that was the basis on which the court inferred that such conversations must have happened in this case. So neither the record nor the theory adopted below supports a contention that what he in fact did was be selective about when he released information.
Your position at the Trotter is that he's out of the case, is that right?
At least with respect to the searches at issue in this appeal. I suppose it would be theoretically possible for our opponents to litigate other searches. I can't imagine why they would, given their confessions here. It's important to remember that what the plaintiffs are seeking to do here is impose supervisory liability and overcome a qualified immunity. And each of those concepts is important. Supervisory liability, the theory, the legal standard this court has adopted, requires a notion of turning a blind eye, the typical supervisory
blind eye. Turning a blind eye to what? Although you don't...
To unconstitutional conduct.
Unconstitutional conduct. But so far as I can see, the only evidence, at least the only evidence that's being cited to us in this case, of unconstitutional conduct is the evidence from the differential search results. Otherwise, what we've got is disparate impact. And then we go to cases like, say, Anderson and Bass, where there's plainly a disparate impact in choosing who to prosecute for crack cocaine offenses. Almost all the defendants are black. The supervisors know that, and the judges know that. And that raises the question whether it's a prima facie case to know that most of the defendants are black. And the Supreme Court has said in Anderson, again, in Bass and Armstrong, that it's not.
Absolutely.
What you need is some reason to think that similarly situated whites are not being prosecuted.
Absolutely.
That's why I asked about the differential success rate. That's where you'd go to show that similarly situated white entrants were not being selected for search. It seems to me if you don't have that, there's just nothing here that would comport with the Supreme Court's requirement in Armstrong and Bass, or for that matter, Personnel Administrator of Massachusetts against Feeney.
We think there is nothing here in the statistics, Judge Easterbrook, for the reasons you say. There was a separate issue about whether we had adequately preserved arguments going to the existence of constitutional violations. We think we did, and we briefed that, but for purposes of this discussion, I think the crucial point is that the statistics here are being used on the supervisory liability point, which the district court said we had preserved. The statistics are being used to impute knowledge to the supervisors.
Yes, but knowledge of what?
I'm
going to spend more time talking to the plaintiff's lawyers about this. But knowledge of disparate impact under cases like Armstrong and Feeney does not require supervisors to do anything.
Exactly.
You have to know of non-selection of identically situated persons.
Exactly, and that's one of that's why the district court concluded, we think correctly, that the statistics can't be a basis for imposing supervisory liability here.
How about Moonen? Of course, there is, that's not based on statistics. It's based on complaints.
I'm not representing Noonan, so I think I'd better let his counsel.
It's time to ask Mr. Noonan's lawyer
to that
question. Mr. Cunningham.
Thank you, Judge Easterbrook.
Mm-hmm.
May it please the court. My name is Ken Kniff. I represent Patrick Noonan. And going back, maybe just to begin by way of talking about the fact this complaint was filed in October of 1997. Noonan was not named until the Seventh Amendment complaint was filed. He filed the answer in front of the defendant.
None of this is is relevant.
Okay.
You might want to get straight to the point.
Well, in answer to your question, mm-hmm. and your question, Judge Easterbrook, what Patrick Noonan did, he was a passenger service representative. He was not an investigator for any agency. As a passenger service representative, he supervised two other people, and then he reported to Mr. Hoteko. What would happen when there was a complaint that was made by anyone, it was his job as the passenger service representative to look at the complaint, go back and find the document which would indicate who the agent was who conducted the search, pull that document, and see if there are any notations on it. He would then direct the two people who he supervised to go find the customs officer involved and ask that agent to respond point for point to the complaint. The record shows, in Judge Hart's opinion, that during this entire period of time, there were a total of 12 complaints filed over a 2.5-year period. Of those 12 complaints that were filed, 8 had something to do which might be relevant to this case. What Mr. Noonan would do would be, he would get the report from the individuals who went out and looked at and talked to the person who was involved. And at that point, okay.
In a claim of racial discrimination, of course, the question is whether complaints were being treated differently according to the race of the complainer. What does the record show about that?
Every complaint was treated in exactly the same fashion. What Mr. Noonan would do would
be... The fashion you've described is one in which no complaint would ever get any useful response because the people who are complained about will always say they were forth on the up and up and did things properly.
Okay, well, there's 2 points on that. I would assume
that... Of course, that would be racially neutral, completely ineffective complaint handling.
And at worst, that would be negligent on his part in terms of supervising it to other people who were doing it. But in this particular case, what would occur was whenever any complaint was made as anything, that the luggage wasn't brought back or any other problems that occurred, he would, in a race-neutral basis, follow exactly the same procedure. He would go back and conduct the same as he would have his two agents talk to the people involved who had done
it. You're saying his liability is diminished because he referred this matter to his two subordinates. Part of your argument?
That's part of the argument, because then when he would get
the response... Where does the buck stop, I guess?
I think that what he would do is he would get the initial response from the two people who he supervised. He would review their response to make sure that it responded point for point to whatever the complaint was that was made, and that the spelling was proper. Certainly not a major supervisory activity. He would then refer the complaint to either Mr. Hoteko or to the district director for their signature. This was not meant to be an investigative agency. This was simply meant that as a passenger service representative, he did his best to assist the passengers. He would have had no knowledge of any statistical data of how many people were searched or not searched. As your honors are aware, at no time was he present for any search. At no time did he have contact with any of the plaintiffs involved in this case during any period of search before, during, or I believe even after. And his role is limited specifically to responding point for point to the complaint that was made.
You just shuffled paper, is that what you're...
I think he would say it's more than simply shuffling papers, but as part of his responsibility, it was his job to go back and assign the two people who work for him to go and talk to the agents who had done the search, or who had performed whatever activity the passengers thought was inappropriate. And based on that, his liability is certainly based on the... it's based at most on mere negligence. Judge Harris's opinion talked about the fact that... he talked about the fact that, as far as he was concerned, no one did no investigations in a proper fashion. I respectfully submit his job was not to be an investigator. His job was to respond point for point to the complaints were made, and he did that in an appropriate fashion. If you have no further questions, we reserve the remainder for rebuttal.
Okay. Thank you very much. Mr. Fox.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is Ed Fox, and I represent the plaintiff. Your Honor asked counsel for the defendants, for Mr. Hoteko in particular, whether we showed an underlying unconstitutional violation, and how did we show it, and made reference to disparate impact. On that issue, the district court decided to assume for the purpose of the motion that was a pattern and practice of unconstitutional activity in connection with the strip searching of black women. In our brief...
The question is, what would notify any of the supervisors that such a pattern exists? Here's my big problem with the case. You, as I understand it, make two particular kinds of arguments. One is that the selection of more black women for search than represented in the incoming pool was such evidence. That shows disparate impact, and under cases like Armstrong and Feeney, knowledge of disparate impact is not knowledge of disparate treatment. They're really quite distinct. You have to show non-selection of similarly situated persons. And the second way of doing that, to show the non-selection of similarly situated persons, you might show that the data imply that white men are being searched too infrequently, not frequently enough. You go deeper into that pool. But your adversary says that his client didn't have those data. So it's awfully hard to see how the defendants have knowledge that any of their underlings might be engaged in discriminatory selection.
Right. What I'll do is paint a broad picture in the mosaic that was going on at Customs, and the atmosphere that was going on at Customs was this. Mr. Hotekel was in charge of passenger processing. He was second in command at O'Hare Airport under Kevin Weeks. He was in charge of the whole processing of passengers and dealt with all the issues in connection with processing passengers. And to give you, there was a whole series of facts which we identified for the district court that indicated they had knowledge of wrongdoing and they turned a blind eye to it. Now, I'll start with the fact that Mr. Hotekel's attitude toward complaints of discrimination were this. In late 1996, shortly before the May 24 date where he was notified about several black women carrying drugs, in late 1996, a woman by the name of Pat Appleton, a black woman who was a travel agent, had been searched repeatedly. She was subjected to another search. An IRL was prepared for her. An IRL was basically an incident report of the search stating the reasons for the search. In the incident report, the customs inspector who was responsible for that indicated, and I quote, "Please stop the madness." In response, because this woman had been repeatedly, unsuccessfully subjected to many searches, and that's what he wrote. Then what happened was...
What does that have to do with discrimination? This is actually a common complaint with searches by the Transportation Security Administration at airports. And the way their computer system works, it turns out there are certain elderly grandmothers who get repeatedly searched for bombs and knives and so on, and they're up in arms about it. But it doesn't indicate that there's discrimination against elderly grandmothers.
The points are twofold. Is this one is this was written by a customs inspector herself, not just a member of the public. But two,
yeah, the head of the TSA, by the way, has what he calls the stupid rule list. It's kind of the please stop the madness, but I don't see how it shows discrimination.
And I'm just using this example to show the attitude of Mr. Hotekel. Hotekel's response to this was, you shouldn't respond and put these sorts of things in writing because this is discoverable information. And that just gives the court an idea of Hotekel's attitude and atmosphere of customs. What was going on then, beginning at about that time, is customs was being deluged with complaints, not only from passengers. And I'm just going to now showing how Mr. Hotekel knew about discriminatory conduct that was going on. He was being deluged with complaints, not just from passengers, but also customs employees, that there was racial targeting of African-American females at customs airport. One complaint, and I'll go through some of the more salient ones that Mr. Hotekel was clearly aware of. One complaint was done by a customs inspector himself named Ray Smith. He complained that several different female customs inspectors were targeting. That was his complaint. They were targeting African American women for searches. He made his complaint. The complaint was brought to the attention of supervisors. The supervisors labeled Mr. Smith somewhat of a psychotic, and he shouldn't be heard from. And the complaint was then brought to Mr. Hotekel, who proceeded to ignore the complaint. That's just one complaint. There was a complaint that was made from a.
What was the factual basis for the complaint? Now, one of the occupational diseases of federal judges, besides back problems, is that we get inured to complaints because every suit is initiated by a complaint, and we quickly discover that most complaints are unsubstantiated. Right? So the question is not, did Jones receive a complaint? What did it have a good factual basis that would alert people to something?
Well, it turns out it did have a good factual basis because the people that Mr. Smith complained of, the two of the four inspectors that he complained of, turned out to be women that were targeting African-American women at a rate 2 to 4 times higher than white travelers. So there was, in fact, indeed, a factual basis for the complaint. Mr.
Was
Smith,
this
I'm sorry.
Stated in the complaint?
The statistical information?
Yes.
No, that was not stated in the complaint.
But that's the problem. Right. Let me go back to crack cocaine prosecutions. People understand that almost all defendants in crack cocaine cases are black. And many of the defendants complain about it. They say this is the result of racial selectivity. The Supreme Court has twice held that That fact and those complaints do not state even a prima facie case of racial discrimination. That what's necessary for the prima facie case is evidence that similarly situated white crack cocaine peddlers are not being prosecuted. That's the key, the Supreme Court says. So the critical question here, one would think, for having a prima facie case is, did these defendants know, or did the complaints that you're talking about point out the non-selection of similarly situated white males, for example?
They did, and the reason why I say they did is that there's a whole mosaic of evidence that has to be looked at, nothing in isolation, and that's the first thing. The second thing is the district court assumed, because it wasn't briefed, it wasn't raised by the defendants in their motion for summary judgment, the district court assumed that there was a pattern and practice of unconstitutional activity. So that's a premise that we have to begin with here, and not to show that a supervisor absolutely knew of a specific case of disparate impact. What we then showed from there is many, not just one, not just from Ray Smith, who was a customs inspector, and he was in a position to know, because he's observing it, black travelers being searched at a disproportionate rate. Then you've got another specific example, and I get the feeling I'm not answering Your Honor's question, but again, all I can say is...
No, it has to be a rate disproportionate to similarly situated people. Otherwise, we're just back to the cocaine case. You would say, blacks are being arrested at a disproportionate rate. We know that because if you look at the supply of people prosecuted for crack cocaine, they're almost all black, and only 12% of the population is black, therefore there must be discrimination. And if that's the nature of the inference, it's identical to the inference that in Bass and Armstrong the Supreme Court held not even to create a prima facie case of race discrimination.
But in most cases, then we're looking at the actual underlying conduct, and we're not here looking at the actual underlying conduct. We're looking at what the supervisors knew, and as Your Honor said, when they knew it. And what the supervisors knew was that they were getting countless complaints, and the complaints were that whites and blacks were being treated dissimilarly. It wasn't just that, and I believe saying that whites are being searched much less than blacks, you've got a disparate impact. And then Ray Smith adds to that he's complaining because these folks are searching women that don't need to be searched. You've got the strong inference that the only reason they're being searched is that they're black. That's what he observed. That's what he saw. When another passenger complained to a DJ Antonio that it appears that there's only blacks back here in secondary, he responded to it in a negative manner. Then he wrote to Mr. Hoteco. He said, I had a hard time persuading her because to me it looked like there were too many blacks in secondary. So now you've got a second example of Mr. Hoteco being put on notice from a customs inspector that there's too many blacks compared to other similarly situated folks getting off these airplanes in the secondary area. On top of that, at the same time this is going on, you have one after another of these complaints by black women travelers, mostly by black women travelers. And Your Honor asked the question of Mr. Kenneth Norman's lawyer of whether white complaints are treated similarly. The only complaints that they were able to produce for us were complaints from black passengers. So those were the only complaints that they ever had to deal with.
Judge Hart characterized this evidence as weak, didn't he?
He characterizes the evidence as weak in connection with the...
May 24th, the evidence on Hoteco is weak.
Right, this is the May 24th incident in which Hoteco was to go back and then discuss the search rates with and the trends was weak. But we think that Judge Hart's ruling was influenced by all the other factors. And what Judge Hart did, what the lower court did in his opinion, was parse out each event and decide each event on its own without looking at the cumulative value of all these events. And we think that we submit that the cumulative value of all these events, when you have cash-based reward systems, you have countless complaints. You have 12 complaints of institutional racism, blacks complaining that one black woman complained she was called a black bitch, other blacks complaining that only blacks are being in secondary, and these complaints kept coming, and then Nunez's response, and in turn, Hoteco's response was to put these complaints under the table. None of these complaints were investigated in any meaningful way. Then the whole atmosphere at Customs was permeated with an...
So you're relying on the complaints more than the ostensible meeting that took place after these black women were found with drugs, is that...
I don't know if I'm relying on it more, but it's a combination, because what happened was, and statistically it's shown that there was black women were being picked out more than white women for searches before May 24th. And then what happened was they had this unusual day, it was a very unusual day for them, when many black women were found with drugs, and after that the numbers of black women that were searched compared to other groups skyrocketed dramatically. Mr. Oteko was privy to this knowledge, not in the sense that the data was compiled, but he would weekly go over the incidences of searches, and he had an ongoing knowledge of who was being searched, where they were being searched, what was being found, and what was not being found. And when the data, and so he had this knowledge because he was in part of these meetings that would discuss these things. When the data was finally put together, it found that black women were being searched at a rate of 44% of all racial gender groups during that year, and yet black women were found to be the least likely group to be concealing narcotics. And I think it's the latter number.
But then it's based on the email of Trotter, is it?
Yes, and actually that was, those are numbers that were corroborated by other sources as well. And the more important number, though, I think there is that the black women were the least likely racial gender group to be carrying narcotics. So they were, Customs was definitely picking the wrong person to be searched. And in fact, the reforms that were initiated by Commissioner Kelly subsequent to this bears this out, because searches went down 71% in the year that the reforms were instituted, and yet seizures of narcotics went up 25% during that time. So it bears out what we were saying, and shows they could have done a better job, and they would have, had they not targeted in a discriminatory manner. The one aspect that I also wanted to deal with, which is that the attorney for Mr. Oteko indicated that liability can be shown only based on the dissemination of one day's fact, and this goes to the appealability of this case in the first place, because it's our contention that the liability of Mr. Oteko as well as Mr. Newman is based upon disputed facts. Mr. Newman's brief, which he never briefed in the underlying court, didn't brief any of the issues in the underlying court, indicates now for the first time three facts that he thinks which should get him qualified immunity. Among these facts is that he delegated responsibility. He says that he never found the same officer to be responsible twice for bad conduct, and he didn't act negligently in doing what he did. We presented many facts in our Rule 56 facts that were presented to the district court that show that this is not true. And as a result, not only should Mr. Newman's appeal be dismissed, it can be denied on the merits because the facts just don't bear out his claim. And his argument that he delegated subordinates is just not accurate, because even his own declaration contradicts that fact to this court. Finally, Mr. Hoteco's argument that, and it was repeated several times, that the only fact that this court is to look at is the fact in connection with the May 24th incident. And it's our contention that this is de novo review, and the court has in front of it all the facts, and this is just another reason that the court needs to look at all these facts, but this is another reason why this case should not be appealable at this point in time, because a factual determination can't be made on summary judgment, notwithstanding the fact that this is a qualified immunity issue. So based on these things, we think that not only was the court right with regard to Oteko, but it could have and should have included all these other facts in connection with why it was not dismissing the claim against Mr. Oteko. One further point that I would like to bring up is that Mr. Oteko in his briefing indicates that the question of whether the law was clearly established was looked at in a too generalized state by the district court in the context of testing the facts against Mr. Hoteco's liability. And I think that all the courts from U.S. v. Lanier on down are in agreement that as long as the contours of a right are clearly established, the precise case or the exact identical facts don't have to be decided in a previous case before a liability can be shown. The liability that we are attempting to show in our brief was merely supervisory liability, which means that we had to show that the supervisors condoned or facilitated, or turned a blind eye to illegal conduct. We weren't called upon to show that there was unconstitutional conduct in the context of the searches. As a result, we didn't do that. And I'd like to emphasize, because a lot of the briefing went to these issues, but not one time in the moving papers of the defendant's briefing in the lower court did they mention the word equal protection or discriminatory intent or discriminatory effect. So as a result of that, we dealt with the issues that we were confronted with. We were confronted with supervisory liability, and we, I believe, put forth a lot of facts and a lot of evidence, particularly in the form of all the complaints that came before the judges, as well as the statistical information that Mr. Holtecker was surely aware of, that showed that they were aware of unconstitutional activity and they did nothing about it. And unless the court has any further questions for me, I'll rest. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anything further? Mr. Cunniff, you had some time, and maybe Mr. Katsas can share some of it. Okay. Mr. Katsas.
Thank you, Judge. Our opponents make very little attempt to defend the district court's opinion on its own terms, which is that liability here can be based solely on the collection and dissemination of
truth. Are you going to address this waiver question at all?
The waiver question goes to whether we preserved the argument that there were no constitutional violations committed by individual supervisors. We think we raised that issue in our opening summary judgment brief, but none of the issues, none of the supervisory liability issues that we've been discussing here turns on it, so I think I'll rest on our briefs. In counsel's attempt to defend the opinion on alternative grounds, he cites statistics. Again, as Judge Easterbrook, as you noted earlier, we have disparate impacts and we have differential search rates, which are unreliable because they exclude positive searches and they reflect small numbers. But you don't need to reach that question because what's undisputed is that they didn't exist at the time of the conduct in question.
When you say they're unreliable because they reflect small numbers, are you meaning something like the T-statistic is very small? Have these been subjected to the normal tests of statistical adequacy?
The theory, the statistics accepted by the district court to show that the TECO's actions might have caused unconstitutional searches were the fact that there was an increase.
Yeah, I know. I'm just asking, when you say they were unreliable, is that because they were not statistically significant when subjected to ordinary tests of significance?
They were not.
And so they have been subjected to ordinary tests of statistical significance.
No, they have not.
Oh, well, then we don't know whether they're statistically significant. And therefore, we also have no basis for the proposition that they are unreliable.
But in any event, they didn't exist at the relevant time.
Okay. Thank you very much, Mr. Katsas.
Thank you.
Thanks to all counsel in this case. The case is taken under advisement.